With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, Ben Smith on his debut novel, Doggerland.
Ben Smith lives in Cornwall and is a lecturer in creative writing at Plymouth University, specialising in environmental literature and focusing particularly on oceans, climate change and the Anthropocene. His first poetry pamphlet, Sky Burials, was published by Walpole Press, and his poetry and criticism have appeared in various journals and anthologies. And Doggerland, which we're going to be talking about today, is his first novel. Ben, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me.
I want to ask how you would describe Doggerland, the novel, first of all.
I normally describe it to people as a novel about two weird guys on a wind farm in a dystopian future. But my publisher and publicity guy tried to urge me not to say things like that.
So, it does pretty much cover it.
So, I guess it's a novel about climate change and about the Anthropocene. And I've always been interested in writing about that. And I was researching Doggerland, the area, and read articles about how they were building wind farms in the middle of the North Sea. And I just thought this would make a wonderful setting for a novel. So really, the novel all comes out of the place in that kind of way. So it's very much a place-based novel as well.
So the Doggerland of your novel, set slightly in the future, is one of... Well, a world that we have limited knowledge of, which we'll talk about perhaps later on, but certainly an environmentally damaged world, a flooded world. And, of course, this area, Doggerbank or Doggerland as once it was, historically was inundated with water. Throughout the novel, you insert sections which are sort of historical accounts of the Doggerland as it was. So perhaps we could talk about that first of all. Tell us about Doggerland.
Yes, well, Doggerland is the name given to the area of land that, as you said, once connected Britain and continental Europe and was flooded and inundated at the end of the last ice age, forming what's now the North Sea and the English Channel. So it was, as you said, a continent, really, that was probably actually the centre for Mesolithic culture in northern Europe at the time, and was flooded during what was really the last major climate change event. And so for me, as someone interested in climate change, this just really spoke to me as an important place to be writing about. And yes, as you said, I've included these sort of short, deep time sections running throughout the novel. And I mean, they don't connect up to the main narrative in a very obvious way, although actually I did sort of use them for structuring the book, which we can always talk about a little bit later, maybe.
Yeah, they do parallel things that happen in the novel.
Yeah, I mean, well, interestingly, I actually, because when I started the novel, I had the setting and I had these characters, but I didn't really know what was going to happen. And I actually used the various stages in the sort of Mesolithic Doggerland as kind of jumping off points for bits of the narrative that I kind of wanted to get to. So there was a bit sort of three quarters of the way through the flooding of Doggerland where people would have become fishermen and they would have been living on small islands, traveling around by boat. So I knew that at that stage I wanted one of my characters to be out on a boat. And so that was actually where that bit of the story came from originally. And then I kind of retrofitted it around the main plot and things like that. So it was quite integral actually to the actual writing of the book, and I was very glad that when I sent it to my agent and publisher, they liked those sections because they're quite strange otherwise.
So tell us about your Doggerland then, the setting, the location of this novel, the place in which the action takes place.
Well, as I said before, it's this vast wind farm set sometime in the future. And I mean, this sort of came from just research into what's going on in the North Sea now. So I was interested in these wind farms that are being built at the moment, I mean, in the North Sea and all across the world. And some of these wind farms are absolutely huge. I mean, they are thousands of square miles in area, thousands of turbines. They're the size of small countries, really. And I love the idea that, particularly in the North Sea, a place like that is being built on top of what was once this kind of hunter-gatherer landscape in the Mesolithic. And so that, for me, just as a purely kind of psychogeographic moment, I found really interesting. And so I kind of thought about these wind farms, and I thought, well, maybe at some point in the future, we might get people living out on these wind farms and living out there and working on these wind farms. And if they did, they would be the first human inhabitants of Doggerland for 8,000 years, which... for me, I was just really fascinated by that as a moment, or a possible moment in the future.
Let's just expand on this future world a little, though. It's worth saying that the novel is also, you know, an exercise in a limited location and a limited cast. There's three main characters who we will talk about in a moment, and indeed their situation is particularly... the character known as the boy, he has limited knowledge of his situation, of what's actually happened. But at the start of the novel, what do we know?
Well, we know that the boy and the old man are out working on the wind farm. We know that they have been out there for a long time, although time is quite hard to judge. The boy has a watch that he keeps checking and replacing the batteries, but it doesn't really work properly. And all of the other clocks that are in the rig where they live are sort of out of sync, and the computer doesn't really work. So we don't really know how long they've been out there. But we know that they're contracted to be out there. They have a contract with the company that they work for that means that they're sort of out there for life, really. And we know that the boy came on to the wind farm to take over his father's contract because his father disappeared, or reneged on his contract is the word that the people say when they give Jem, the boy, his contract on the farm. So that's really all that we know at the beginning.
And this company, referred to as the company in the book, tell us something about them.
Well, I wanted this sort of idea of this sort of vast, sprawling corporation of some kind that owned the energy production, maybe owned vast amounts of the mainland perhaps as well. There's sort of a suggestion that maybe the boy was kind of brought up in the company almost. So that idea of sort of a corporation maybe superseding the nation state as the main authority. And again, as you said, I sort of intentionally left this sort of vague, as I think people are quite familiar with that as an idea, I think. And so I felt like I didn't really have too much to say about that I thought was maybe necessarily interesting or new per se to do with the company. So I kind of just set that up and left it, really.
And the book has a quote from the brilliant novelist and friend of the show, Melissa Harrison, describing the book as the road meets Waiting for Godot. And I've seen a few people refer to Beckett in describing it, and in one of those ways, as well as the sort of limited characters and the character interactions, I mean, we know why the boy and the old man are at these wind turbines, because they're there to repair them and they have this contract, but we don't really know whether that's even worth doing.
yeah, that was something that I was really interested in exploring, and I was very pleased when Melissa Harrison said that about the book, and the other people in reviews had mentioned Beckett and things like that, because it basically, yes, me shamelessly ripping off Beckett but putting it on a wind farm, I think, and that's certainly what I was going for with the book. I absolutely love Beckett's writing. I think there's sort of two people in the world. There's people that find Beckett horribly depressing, and there's people that find Beckett really funny, and I find Beckett funny and very human, actually. I think Waiting for Godot and Endgame, I love the relationship between the characters in those. And so, yeah, I was sort of interested in writing this two-hander kind of thing, but trying to give it a bit more of a narrative than Beckett does, because I realized quite early on that I couldn't just have two guys sitting out on a wind farm and talking to each other endlessly, however much I would have loved to have written that.
But central to the novel is this relationship between the boy and the old man. They do have names, but you know, it's a device you use in the book to often not refer to them by name, and I want to talk about why.
Yeah, I mean, that was partly to sort of emphasize the generational aspect of it, because the book's sort of all about generations, really, and what we inherit from generation to generation, and that kind of thing. But also, it was really just what I felt maybe was an element of realism there, in that if you are actually just out living and working only ever with one other person, you probably wouldn't really use their name very much. And so you would almost become these sort of nameless figures, because you wouldn't use the other person's name in that kind of way. And I was also thinking about jobs I've had where you've got groups of men kind of working together, and often young people be called the boy and older people be called the old man. So I was, kind of referencing that sort of thing, I think, as well with that.
You've said a little about the boy already. Tell us something about the old man. What do we know of him?
Well, the old man is quite a strange figure. And really, I mean, if the boy is someone who wants to fix things and keep things going and get on with work, the old man is a persistent procrastinator and will always be looking for other things that they can do other than getting on with their work. And one of the things that he's particularly interested in is trawling the seabed for artifacts from the Doggerland that was, which is deep beneath the waves. And so he fills his room with all kinds of fossils and things that have been trawled up from the seabed. And really here, this all came from sort of research that I was doing into the archaeologists who were working on Doggerland, the sorts of things that they've found there. And I really like the idea of, well, if you were stuck out on a wind farm in the middle of the North Sea, probably you'd try to trawl up some stuff and see what you could find. So in that sense, the old man is sort of someone who maybe looks more to the past, whereas the boy maybe is more interested in the present and what's going on now.
And you've mentioned that the boy is there under contract to replace his father, who has disappeared. And I don't want to talk too much about that, because it's sort of central to the plot of the novel. We don't want to give too much away. But there is a third character, the pilot of a supply ship that brings them their food, fundamentally, and also is sort of like antagonistic. Tell us something about him.
Yeah, I really enjoyed writing the pilot, because he's really just a git, I enjoyed writing him, and I think practically I needed there to be some kind of contact with the mainland. So in a way, he's sort of a device whereby, you know, it makes sense that they get food delivered and things like that, but in a controlled way, and it's controlled by someone who, as you said, is antagonistic to them, and so would want to be able to kind of put the squeeze on them when necessary if he wants to trade with them or change the terms in which they trade. But also, yes, he's kind of central to the plot, in that he drops hints about the boy's father that really kickstarts the plot, actually, and makes the boy start thinking about what might have happened to his father and start doubting what the old man has said or not said about what happened to his father. And as we mentioned before, about the what we know or don't know about about what's going on shore, I wanted the knowledge that we get to sort of be filtered through the pilot. So I mean, the pilot says, you know, things are bad on shore, and maybe they are bad, maybe they are getting worse, or maybe he's just saying that because he wants to be able to trade in a more favorable way for him with the components he's sort of black market trading with the boy and the old man. So yeah, we never really know what's going on back on shore, and apart from what the pilot tells us and what the boy can kind of hazily remember.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Ben Smith about his debut novel, Doggerland. And Ben, I wanted to talk about, I mean, I guess go back to Beckett in a way, and talk more about this, the central relationship between the boy and the old man, but particularly in terms of writing about boredom. They're in this very restricted setting, doing a fundamentally, you know, repetitive manual job, with only each other's company. Tell me about how you've expressed that through the novel.
Yeah, I mean, this was always something I sort of wanted to write about. I've always loved those stories where not a lot happens. But at the same time, while I wanted to sort of express boredom, I wanted to try and do so in a way that isn't in and of itself boring. And this, again, was playing around with the limitations of the setting. I love the idea that we wouldn't ever leave this wind farm, but that does pose a problem when you've got to fill a novel with things that could happen on a wind farm. So I have pages and pages in my notebooks that list simply entitled things that could happen on a wind farm. And I just started thinking about, well, what could they literally do with their time? And apparently there's 208 pages of things that can happen on an offshore wind farm, as I've managed to get in the novel. The important thing with writing about boredom is to make sure that the boredom is varied. So I try to make sure that every scene where we just have a conversation between the boy and the old man, that they're doing something slightly different. So there's never sort of two scenes where they're doing exactly the same thing. But also, I think, importantly, I did want to make sure that every scene, or at least every chapter, gave us some bit of information that did actually further the plot as well. So I did try, you know, I was trying really hard there to, whilst writing about not a lot happening, to try and make sure that, you know, things did happen and there was a kind of a rising in conflict or development of the plot in some way in each of those scenes.
And I want to talk also about the idea of writing these characters against the nature, I guess, against the setting, because we're talking about both. The sea is, you know, vast and deep, and these wind farms, these wind turbines are tall. But there's also an element of time about the, you know, because obviously the book has the historical sections, the idea of human beings against sort of deep time as well.
Yeah, and that was something that I was particularly interested in really exploring and experimenting with in the novel. And I mean, one of the issues with climate change, or one of the problems of writing about climate change, is this problem of scale, which is what we're really talking about here. The problem that our actions, compared to the effects of climate change, our individual actions seem so small and so insignificant, and yet it's the cumulative impact of these insignificant actions that is causing these vast global changes, which will in turn then have huge impacts on our lives. And yeah, I was trying to think about ways of enacting that throughout the novel. And one was using those sort of deep time sections where I have the story of the inundation of Doggerland. So just setting that against this very, very small story of two guys on a wind farm and one of them looking for his father, this very human story, but giving it that kind of that scale or that perspective where we suddenly zoom out and see it for this small story that it is. But also realizing that just because human actions are small, that doesn't mean they're insignificant. They're just maybe not as significant as we thought they were, or significant in different ways. So, so that was really what I was interested in doing, was exploring those issues of scale and thinking about how we can play around with those.
And I want to sort of, I mean, ask, I guess, a similar question, but in terms of more generally writing fiction about climate change, you know, how to, you know, get across the urgency of what is actually happening to our world through fiction.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a question that I'm always asking myself, like, what can fiction add to this debate, which seems so governed by the language of science, really? And I mean, the thing that I always come back to is the way that fiction hopefully can engage us emotionally with these stories. And also the way that fiction is, I mean, inherently about causality. You know, a novel is effectively structured around characters having desires or doing something that has these knock-on effects and creates some kind of change. So in many ways, it's actually a really good form for exploring the very complex cause and effect changes that are coming about with climate change. So, I was interested in using the novel as a kind of, I mean, almost like a kind of experiment, almost like a scientific model, if you like, where you put characters into this situation and then you see what comes out at the end and see what changes might be affected or what might change or what might not change as well.
And again, writing about possible futures, you know, the novel set in a future where there's been, you know, catastrophic climate change, and obviously the particular setting that you've chosen sort of dictates what that setting is going to be like. But I just wanted to talk about, as you were writing the book, like imagining possible futures.
Yeah, it's interesting with that. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I intentionally kept the focus small, kept the focus narrow, sorry, just on the wind farm, because I sort of didn't want to get too entangled in much bigger sort of global predictions on what this climate change future might look like. We could be fairly certain that if things carry on as they are, the oceans will rise and weather would become less predictable. So I sort of focused on that particularly. But I think also in terms of the sort of wider world, I think there are so many other great writers who have written brilliant novels about climate change that I sort of didn't, well, maybe it's partly this being my debut novel, I didn't feel like I could sort of come up with a vision of the future that would stand up against Margaret Atwood or someone like that. So I sort of decided to just not, and focus just on this wind farm. And also I think just sort of trust that my readers would I guess, of be able to infer whatever they wanted really about this climate change future. I mean, I did think at one point about, you know, trying to make kind of predictions about, you know, what society might be like. But actually, I think at the time I was writing it, I think I had a sort of idea that maybe Britain would be part of some European super state. And then as a publication date got closer, Brexit happened. And so I thought, well, I'm quite glad I didn't make that prediction in my novel, as that would feel pretty ridiculous now. I didn't feel confident enough, I think, to make these sort of big grand predictions. But I hope that maybe I've done enough to suggest that this sort of stuff is going on. And there was some specific stuff that I did try and get in there. So I've been working a lot in my sort of job as lecturer at Plymouth University. I've been working a lot with marine scientists down there. So I was trying to get in bits of the research that they've been doing into things like ocean acidification and species loss in the ocean and microplastics and things like that. So, I mean, the boy spends a lot of his time fishing, but there's never any real indication that he's ever even caught a fish in the entire time that he's been doing this, because species loss in the ocean is a really serious issue. And again, one of those things that could very likely happen, certainly large species loss. So there were little bit things like that I wanted to try and get in, but I sort of shied away from making big predictions about the future.
Oh, well, talking about those scientists that, you know, perhaps were an influence, and obviously we've talked about Beckett, but I wondered what other writers were an influence on the novel.
I mean, in terms of this novel particularly, I was sort of influenced by Cormac McCarthy was another one, and that sort of tradition of those sort of, I guess, grim male American writers like Hemingway and Steinbeck, who write in that kind of pared down sort of style. I think this, again, for me, was one of those things that I got what they were doing with their style, and because it's so pared down, I thought that might be a good thing to experiment with or to try out for my first novel. So those were the sort of direct influences. But I mean, more broadly, in terms of a novel that's all based around setting and place, those are the sorts of books that I'm most interested in, where the story and the characters really come out of the setting. So in that sense, writers like Annie Proulx with her visions of Wyoming, or even a writer like Laurie Moore with her very urban American settings that generate a particular type of character. So yeah, there's a lot of authors that I'm interested in and enjoy their work. But I think definitely in terms of style, it was writers like Hemingway, McCarthy and then Beckett.
Just to finish off then, can I get you to read us some of Doggerland?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm just going to read here from the beginning of the novel. Bootlaces. Nothing, 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 something. Fourth hook down on the drop line, there was a dark shape. The boy stopped pulling and sat back on his heels. The swell was small that day, and it was more than 3 meters from the platform down to the sea. The boy watched as the shape stretched and buckled beneath the grey water. Strange fish, he said to no one. The wind was blowing in from the west, consistent, 10 or 11 meters per second by the feel of it, droning through the platform's pipes and grills and pushing the sea into hard ridges. The North Sea shifted from horizon to horizon, like a tarpaulin being dragged over rough ground. It looked sluggish, but under the surface, currents ripped and surged. It was hard to imagine the sheer tonnages hauling past every minute, every second. The boy wound the line around the railing until it was secure, then took hold of the hanging length, lifted it a few inches and let it fall. He moved it from side to side, but the hook was lodged. He'd have to pull it up. He moved the line again. It was heavy, whatever it was. He hoped his line wouldn't break. It had taken him a long time to get that length of cord. How long? Months? Years? He looked out at the horizon as if it would give him an answer, but couldn't even pick out where the grey of the sea became the grey of the sky. It was good cord. That was all that mattered. And 100 miles offshore, it wasn't easy to get hold of good cord. Could you even get proper fishing line anymore? The wind squalled and worked itself through the seams of his overalls. Who could he ask? The old man wouldn't know. He didn't know. And there was no one else out there. He stood up, set his feet shoulder width apart, and pulled his sleeves down over his hands. He moved his hands slowly and kept the rest of his body very still, as if trying to steady himself against the motion of sea and sky. His legs were planted almost a metre apart, and his sleeves barely covered his wide, calloused palms. Of course, the boy was not really a boy, any more than the old man was all that old. But names are relative, and out in the grey some kind of distinction was necessary. He took hold of the line and, using the rail as a fulcrum, began to haul it up out of the water. As soon as the load broke the surface, the line tightened and rasped through his sleeves. He stopped for a moment and let the wind smooth the edges of the pain, then carried on pulling until the fourth hook was level with the platform. He looked down over the rail. It was a load of junk as usual, a greasy mass of netting and plastic, streaming and reeking. The whole thing was tangled into a dense lump, along with an oil can, some polystyrene, and what looked like a burnt-out panel from a door. The boy tied off the line, straightened his back, and blew lightly on his palms. "Good catch," he said. Beside him, the thick steel support rose 20 meters to the rig. Above the rig's squat rectangular housing, the blades of the nearest turbine turned slowly in the washed-out sky. All around, to every horizon, the blades of the wind farm turned.
I've been talking to Ben Smith. We've been talking about his debut novel, Doggerland, which is out in the UK from Fourth Estate. Ben, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.